talk about something was kind of a side interest of mine. As many of you will know, my main line of work is in what we call the TOPOS approach to quantum theory, and it will show up towards the end of the talk, but this can be understood very much independently of this, and well, it's a way of thinking about quantum observables in a somewhat non-standard way, and has to do with probability. So I found this nice quote by David Hume, and let's hope I can do my best to contribute to this. So plan of the talk is quite simple. There's some introduction and background, and I'll define what we call these Q observable functions. These are these functions representing observables. Then I'll give some probabilistic interpretation, and in the last part, this is what does relate to the TOPOS approach. I'll say something about some new kind of joint sample space for quantum observables, which does exist despite certain no-go theorems. You would not expect that it exists. So let's see how far we get with this. So of course, we all know that observables of a quantum system are described by self-adjoint operators, so linear operators on Hilbert space. That's quantum mechanics 101, and that's how we always think about them. And this, of course, means we can add self-adjoint operators, we can multiply them with real numbers, and they form a real vector space. Now, of course, mathematically, that's very natural, especially in a finite dimension of matrices, and it's a mathematical reflex to add matrices, to multiply them by numbers. I mean, this is very natural to do this. The physics interpretation of this is much less clear. For example, what is the interpretation of position plus momentum? You can certainly form this, but it's not very clear at all what this is supposed to mean. But even if you have two observables like kinetic and potential energy, which are of the same kind, you can, of course, form, as you always do, the Hamiltonian is the sum of these two. But even if you know very well the spectrum of kinetic energy, and which is just a positive real line, of course, if you just think of this term and the spectrum of your potential and, you know, all the eigenspaces, doesn't tell you anything about the eigenspaces and eigenvalues of H, of the sum of these two. So the point I want to make here, and this, of course, very well known, that the relation between the linear aspects and the spectral aspects of self-adjoint operators are notoriously tricky. It's very difficult to say something about how these aspects relate. And in this talk, I'll focus on some other aspect, not on linearity, but on order. I'll explain what I mean by this in much more detail, of course, but this will allow us to get this new perspective on quantum observables and will allow us to write them as actual real-valued functions. And I want to say I do not mean expectation value functions, and I do not mean Wigner functions. So it's a new thing as far as I know. And this does relate in some way to probability theory, as I'll show in the second half of the talk, and it also leads to this idea of having a joint sample space. And the talk is actually based on two papers you can find in the archive, and they're both with Barry DeWitt, who was my master's student in Oxford, and we worked beyond that and have these two papers out. And in the papers, we treat for Neumann algebras, actually, and unbounded operators. And to keep things somewhat simpler, I want to focus here just on the algebra of all bounded operators on Hilbert space and on bounded operators. But if you look at the papers, you'll find a bit more than what I'll talk about today. We need a little bit of preparation. I hope that most of this is a reminder and you're familiar with these things. So the first thing I want to define is a partially ordered set, and this is a very simple definition. It's a set with a partial order, which is a binary relation. It's reflexive, antisymmetric, and transitive. That shouldn't be surprising. I'll give you a few examples in a second. And a pole set, a partially ordered set, the pole set is bounded. It has a bottom element, which you write 0 typically, and the top element 1. And of course, 0 is smaller than any other element, and 1 is larger than any other element. Examples are to take any set Y and look at the set of all its subsets. That's a partially ordered set, and the partial order is inclusion. Another example is the real numbers, and the order is just the usual one, and this is a total order because you can compare any two elements. A non-example would be the complex numbers. They do not form a partially ordered set in an obvious way. Now, when you have an order, you can also ask, do least upper bounds and greatest lower bounds exist? And let's take two elements, x and y, in a partially ordered set. X, the so-called meet, which we write with this symbol here, is the greatest lower bound of x and y. This may or may not exist, of course. And what does this mean? It means, of course, that x meet y is smaller than x meet y is smaller than y. And if you have any other element that's also smaller than x and y, it's already smaller or equal to x meet y. So this makes it the greatest lower bound. And if a pole set has all such binary meets, then it's called a meet semilattice. And you may, moreover, have a situation where you take an arbitrary family, not just two elements, arbitrarily many, and you look for greatest lower bound for such a family. If this always exists, you call the pole set X a complete meet semilattice. Of course, there's a dual notion, which is least upper bounds, and they're called joins. So a join is written this way, X join Y. Of course, that is larger than x and larger than y. And if you have any other element z that's also larger than x and y, then it's already larger or equal to the join. So it's exactly the dual notion. Pole set which has binary joins is a join semilattice. And if any family has this, there's a typo, this should be a big join here. As a join, then x is called a complete join semilattice. And now, a lattice, of course, is a partially ordered set that is both things at the same time. It's a join semilattice and a meet semilattice. And a lattice is complete if all meets and joins exist. So if it's a complete meet semilattice and a complete join semilattice. Moreover, a lattice may or may not be distributive. This set of conditions here. This basically says the meets and joins play nicely with each other, as you would expect naively. But that does not hold in every lattice. Now, here are a few examples. We can again look at the subsets of a set Y. This is bounded because there's a bottom element, which is the empty set. There's a top element, which is the whole set. It is a complete lattice, and it's distributive. The real numbers with the usual order form a distributive lattice. Meets are given as infima and joins as suprema. But this is not a bounded lattice. There's clearly no smallest real number and no largest one. So not all joins exist. For example, you cannot take the join over all elements of R, so it's not a complete lattice. Rational numbers in the unit interval form a bounded lattice, quite obviously. It's a distributive one, but again, it's not complete because you can have a sequence of rational numbers converging to a real number. So this is why it's not complete in this case. Okay. The real numbers, we get this idea, some lattices are almost complete. There's not much lacking from them being complete. And there's a notion for this as well. Lattice is called boundedly or conditionally complete if the following holds. If you take any family that does have some upper bound, it already has a least upper bound. And also any family that has a lower bound has a greatest lower bound. If that does hold, then you call the lattice boundedly complete. So this is not an example. This is a non-example, but I'll make it an example. This is an example, of course, yes, but I'll make it into a complete lattice by adding a bottom element, which, of course, I'll write as minus infinity, and adding a top element, plus infinity. So the boundedly complete lattice of real numbers can be made complete by going to what we call the extended reals, just adding in minus and plus infinity. Okay, and we'll need this later on. Okay, there's more stuff you can define with lattices. I'll just do this quite quickly because we won't be using it very much. But you may have something that corresponds to, a complement. And a complement or the complementation function on the lattice L is a map, which are prime here. that has the following properties. So X prime join X is the top element. X prime meet X is the bottom element. If you take this, which means you take the complement twice, you get back to where you started from, and taking complements reverses the order. A lattice which has this is called an ortho-complemented lattice, or ortholattice. And you also know that there are these so-called orthomodular lattices. They are ortholattices which have a further property. When X is smaller than Y, then this holds. This actually is some weakening of distributivity. We don't want to go into this for now, but I want to give you an example that will play a role later on if you look at the projection operators on Hilbert space. They form, first of all, a non-distributive lattice. It is a complete lattice and is orthomodular. Non-distributivity is very easy to see, actually. I can show this in a minute. So I just take my Hilbert space to be two-dimensional, so I can draw this here on the whiteboard. Take three one-dimensional subspaces. let's actually take this. I learned this example from Chris Eich. I always like to use this as the quantum breakfast. So go to the quantum hotel and they offer you X and bacon or sausage. This is a logical reading of these meets and joins. This is right, this and this is right, this or. What you would expect to get is X and bacon or X and sausage, like in any decent hotel. But let's check this. B join S is actually the smallest subspace that contains these two one-dimensional subspaces. That's the whole plane, the whole whiteboard or blackboard here. It's very good that you have blackboards here, not whiteboards. EN, this is the intersection of this subspace with the whiteboard, so it's with the blackboard, so it's actually E itself. But here, this is the intersection of the two subspaces, which is just the origin. Likewise, this is the intersection of these two subspaces. Again, it's just the origin. And the join of these two doesn't change, it's still the origin. So these two things are not equal, it's not particularly exotic, but this means this is a non-distributive lattice. Now we're moving to something which is maybe less familiar, but this is where it starts to get interesting, actually. We want to compare two pole sets. We want to put them in some nice relation. And some very nice relation you can have between two pole sets is the following. Let's call the partially ordered sets P and Q. And we have one function from P to Q and another function from Q to P. We'll call F and G these functions. Of course, we have ordered sets, so we want our functions to preserve the order. They are monotone functions. And if the following condition holds, F of P is smaller or equal to Q if and only if P is smaller than G of Q, then these two pole sets with these two functions form what is called a Galois connection. And this function F is then called the left adjoint and G is called the right adjoint. And this is not in any operator sense, it's a sense of category theory. So if you can find such a function G for a given function F, then it's already unique. So F determines G uniquely and the other way around. If they exist, they are unique. So I already hinted at the fact that this can all be understood in category theory, which is a nice language for talking about these things. We won't be doing this much, but I want to mention it here. When you think of a partially ordered set as a category, you would take as objects the elements in your partially ordered set, and you would have an arrow from, let's say, an element P1 to P2, if and only if P1 is smaller or equal to P2. So you would express the order just using arrows in your category. And in this view, a monotone function from P to Q is a functor between these two categories. And such a Galois connection categorically is an adjoint pair of functors. And that's an important concept in category theory. But the question, of course, arises under which conditions do such Galois connections exist? When can I say I have one of these guys. And there's a very nice result, and that's called the adjoint functor theorem for pole sets. And that's more or less what this talk is based on. So most of the results follow from this if you apply it to aspects of quantum theory. So let's look at this quite carefully. We have two pole sets, P and Q. We assume them to be complete joined semilattices. Now a map F from P to Q has a right adjoint G from Q to P if and only if F preserves all joints. What does this mean? You can take any family of elements in P, and then F of the join over all these elements is the join over F applied to PI. So this is what it means to preserve joints. And if F does that, it does have a right adjoint called G. In this case, G will actually preserve all meets, so the corresponding rule. And then you may ask, okay, we had a joint semilattices, now we talk about meets, but in any complete joint semilattice, you can define meets as well. You can define meets in terms of joints, so meets also exist. And there's a converse to this. You can start from a map G from Q to P between complete meet semilattices now, and this will have a left adjoint F from P to Q if and only if G preserves all meets, and then again F will preserve all joints. So it goes both ways, of course, and this is a key result. It's actually it's one of these things I found enormously useful, and I think everyone has these results where I think everybody should know this. Yeah. This is one of the results where I think everybody should know it. Yeah. And of course, not my result. This is pretty standard. I want to point out that the pole sets do not need to be distributive for this to hold. There's no condition of that kind. So we now have a nice way of relating two pole sets, at least if meets or joints are preserved in the right way. Now, okay, we want to do something in quantum theory, and we want to apply this to operators in some way. And so let's look at order on operators. And the usual thing you would do is you take the so-called linear order. So you take two self-adjoint operators, A and B, and you define typically A is smaller than B if and only if B minus A is a positive operator. That's the usual definition. It clearly uses the linear structure because you form B minus A here. Now this is very useful in many respects, but Kedersen showed already in 51 that two self-adjoint operators have a meet if and only if A is smaller than B or B is smaller than A. If you can already compare them, they have a meet, and then of course it's the smaller of the two. But in general, meets do not exist. Greatest lower bounds do not exist if you take operators that do not relate to each other this way. There's nothing you can say. So you do not get a lattice. You actually get something which is very far from being a lattice. Kedersen called this an anti-lattice. That's not good for us. That's not what we want to use. We want to organize self-adjoint operators into some lattice, so we need another order. Yes? Yeah. This will actually be answered on this slide, but it's a good question, of course. Yeah. Olsen introduced another kind of order called the spectral order on self-adjoint operators. So again, you have two self-adjoint operators, A and B, and you look at their spectral families. Is everyone familiar with spectral families? So it's... No? Some people not, other people... But, so who does not... Well, who knows what a spectral family is? Not enough, hands. I'll show you. Basically, you know the spectral theorem. And the spectral theorem, at least in finite dimensions, tells you that you can, you can diagonalize the self-adjoint operator. You can write it as a sum, I equals 1 to n, ai, pi. And these are the eigenvalues, these are the projections on the corresponding eigenspaces. And so all these projections are pairwise orthogonal to each other. This is really very basic quantum theory. Now, we can define a map. We define this E. A I'm writing up there. This is indexed by the real numbers. So for every real number, I get a projection. Which projection do I get for the real number R? This is the sum over all I smaller. Let me check, and smaller equal to R actually, of all these P I's. You just add up the projections onto these eigenspaces up to R. So when you think about it, it will start with a zero projection. If R is really small, smaller than the smallest eigenvalue, then you have the zero projection. Then you come to the first eigenvalue. So here's A1. It jumps up, and jumps up exactly by P1, of course. And it stays constant until you hit the second eigenvalue. And then it jumps up again. Let's say this here is P2, and so on. So you get kind of such a step function, which eventually will go to 1. The spectral family is this step function, if you like. It's a growing family of projections going from 0 to the identity. And the steps upwards are always by the eigenspaces. So the spectral order compares not the operators directly, but it compares these spectral families. And the definition is A is spectrally smaller than B, if and only if for every real number R, you have the spectral projection of A at R is larger or equal to spectral projection of B at R. It seems the wrong way around, because here I have larger than, here I have smaller than, but it's actually made such that on projections, it gives you the usual order. This is because in the spectral family of a projection, you get first to the eigenvalue 0, and this has projection 1 minus p. This projection on the eigenspace of 0 is this 1 minus p. So this reverses the order. This is why you have this reversal of order here. Now, if you put this order on the self-adjoint operators, it behaves much better. It gives you boundedly complete letters. So many, many meets and joins exist. On projection operators and on commuting operators, it is the same as the usual linear order. This answers this question you had. So it generalizes the order on projections, but in a different way than the usual linear order. And you have the following: if A is smaller than B in the usual sense, then it's also spectrally smaller than B. And being spectrally smaller actually is equivalent that for every power, you have an smaller or equal to bn. So being spectrally smaller is a weaker condition. It's a coarser order than the linear order. Okay, it's not very well known, but it's quite useful, actually. So now we're in the position to actually define these functions I want to define. I want to look at these spectral families. And there's one extra condition one usually imposes. This is more or less a convention, but it's a usual convention. It's called right continuity. So basically, you're asking, if I come to such a step here, if you come from the right, that you do not fall down at this point. Well, if you come from the left, you may jump up. Basically, you have to introduce a convention where how the step is taken. The step is taken this way. The right continuity says if you take the meet over all spectral projections for values s larger than R, get the one at R. Okay. Now, the observation we made is that this exactly means that a spectral family is a map from the real numbers into the projections that preserves all meets. And then, of course, we have partially ordered sets on both sides. We have a meet-preserving map. It should have an adjoint in this sense I was talking about. It's just a tiny problem. We have a complete lattice here, but this is not complete as we already saw. But this can easily be fixed. We just go to the extended reals. So we extend our spectral family. We define at minus infinity, must be zero. That's a canonical thing, of course. And at plus infinity must be one. This doesn't add anything. And then you get a map from the extended reals to the projections that actually preserves all meets. So it will have a left adjoint just by this adjoint functor theorem. And so we define this left adjoint and give it a name. And we call this the Q observable function of A. Well, this is a function going the other way. So it goes from projection operators to the extended reals. So it's a real valued function on the projections. It is an adjoint, so it is uniquely determined by the spectral family. The spectral theorem tells you the spectral family gives you a unique self-adjoint operator. So we already see we can think of operators as these functions. They were actually first found by de Grote, who's my PhD supervisor in Frankfurt, and there's one paper by Henri Comment. They both did not use this definition we're using here, which is the most natural, I would argue. So the adjoint functor theorem actually gives us a bit more. It gives us a concrete form. So how does this function look like? It's this function. So a projection P is sent to the infimum over all real numbers such that the spectral projection EA at R is larger or equal to P. So this means that this value OAP is the smallest value R such that the subspace spanned by all the spectral spaces of A for values small or equal to R contains this subspace that P projects onto. So go as high up with your R as you have to cover P with EAR. We'll interpret this function in a more direct way or in a more transparent way, but that's literally what this says here. It's easy to see if you put in the zero projection, you get minus infinity. So just check this. But if you put in any non-zero projection, you get something which is at least as large as the smallest value in the spectrum of the operator. And in fact, there's this nice little result here. If you look at the non-zero projections, then the values that this function I just defined takes are exactly the spectrum of A. So that's, of course, what you would hope for. And the proof, I'll not go through the proof, but the proof is really just four lines. So it's nothing complicated there. This is why we had to do so much preparation, because now everything is easy. This is always in category theory. You do a lot of preparation, and then things fall out more or less. Okay, but for now, we still had to put in an operator. We don't want to do this. We want to say abstractly, what kind of functions do we need to do this? And here's the definition. So I take a function from the projection operators to the extended reals, and there are two conditions. It has to preserve joints, which joins in the extended reals are suprema. And secondly, the image on non-zero projections must be a compact subset of the real line. And such a function O is called an abstract Q-observable function. And the thing here, of course, is there's absolutely no reference to linear operators. This does not look like a linear operator at all. But it's not very hard to show. You can basically guess this already. Such a function will have a right adjoint. This will be a spectral family. This indeed does give us a self-adjoint operator. So these abstract Q-observable functions actually correspond bijectively to the Q-observable functions coming from operators. So every such function does give you an operator, and every operator gives you one such function. So just introduce a bit of notation. If you write QO for the set of all Q-observable functions and SF, the set of spectral families, then we have shown so far that there are bijections. You have as many self-adjoint operators as spectral families. That's just the spectral theorem. And you have as many Q observable functions. This is why this Galois connection. Okay, I emphasized order a lot in the beginning. Where's the order? We already saw this definition of the spectral order, which says that the set of spectral families with this reversed order here is isomorphic to the self-adjoint operators with the spectral order. That's basically the definition of the spectral order. And then it's not very hard to show, well, what kind of order would you put on the Q-observable functions? Well, these are actual functions. The simplest order you can always put on a set of functions, the pointwise order. And this just means you compare at every single projection separately. If you compare two of them, you evaluate them on projections and you compare actually in the real numbers that you map into. That's the simplest order you can come up with, and the way it's made just shows that there is an order isomorphism between the self-adjoint operators with the spectral order and the Q-observable functions with this pointwise order. So the somewhat complicated spectral order becomes really simple on this side of the story, becomes a pointwise order. And this also tells us that this must be a boundedly complete lattice, because this is. And if they're all isomorphic, they must have the same properties. So what I've shown, I said, well, I want to emphasize order. By doing this and pick the spectral order on self-adjoint operators, I get a representation. You can think of this as a representation theorem. I represent the boundedly complete lattice of self-adjoint operators by this lattice of Q-observable functions with a pointwise order. Okay, what can we do with these guys? So one thing I want to indicate very briefly, because there was a motivation for us, is to understand a certain map we had from Topos' approach from some other part. And there you sometimes want to talk about approximations of self-adjoint operators with respect to the spectral order, and so don't even want to go into this, but you actually want to do this in the following sense. You look at your algebra of all bounded operators where you've on your Hilbert space, and you look at a commutative subalgebra in there. And you have some self-adjoint operator, but typically does not lie within V, so you have to approximate. And you do this approximation of A to V by taking the smallest operator in V that is spectrally larger or equal to A. And we want to do this at the end of the day for all the commutative subalgebras. So in principle, we would have to calculate uncountably many of these approximations. That's not very practical. And by the way, this map is called the outer dozenization of A to V. And what you can show is something quite nice. So you can go to the Q-observable function of this approximation. And the result is that is simply given by, you take the Q-observable function of A, the non-approximated one, which is defined on all projections on Hilbert space, and just restrict it to the projections in your commutative subalgebra. So the simplest thing you can do with the function is always restrict it to a smaller domain. And that gives you this approximation you want. And this works for all V, so you don't have to explicitly do this approximation in any sense. You just restrict the one function you have and gives you all these approximations for all the different Vs. You just restrict to the projections in the smaller algebras. That's quite handy because it means we can actually deal with this and we can encode all this in one function. Another little thing is, how does it behave under taking functions? And of course, the functions you can apply must be monotone of some kind, and you get such a relation. And if you know a bit of operator algebra theory, it's kind of a limited form of function calculus for these functions. But physically, it's the following. You sometimes want to rescale. You have a set of outcomes, and you want to, one of the simplest things, you want to change units. Let's say you want to go from degrees Celsius to degrees Fahrenheit. So you rescale. You do it in an order-preserving way. That's usually a sensible thing to do. This just tells you that these functions behave well with respect to rescalings. Okay. Now, we still, well, we see that we can think of self-adjoint operators as functions, and we have some results, what you can do with them, but we were not very happy with this because we didn't really see what these functions are. What do they mean? Yeah. And this only becomes clear when you look at probabilistic aspects, and this is what I want to do now. And this is directly from the Wikipedia article on random variables, and I put this there because to me this was always very mystifying. Yeah. This is something I could not understand, a random variable. I mean, I can see the mathematical definitions of these things, but what does it mean to be a variable whose value is subject to variations due to chance, i.e. randomness in a mathematical sense? And this actually, they give a link to some actually proper textbook. It's not some hobbyist who put this on Wikipedia. So. At least this, I put this there because we now want to talk about quantum random variables, which of course is even more mysterious. And it helped me a little bit to understand what's going on there. So I hope this becomes somewhat clear. But first of all, we have to look at classical probability and some standard material here, but maybe some stuff is not so well known. So in classical probability, of course, have a sample space around this omega, and you want to look at measurable subsets or Borel subsets of your sample space. I write these as B of omega. And a random variable is a function, actually, from your sample space to the real numbers. And actually, you want this function to be a measurable function, a Borel function. And you can also talk about probability measures. These are maps from these Borel subsets of your sample space to 0, 1 to probabilities. So this is a probability measure. So if you want to calculate the probability that the outcome of a measurement of A lies in a Borel set delta, which is some subset of the real numbers, if the state is mu, we form mu of a to the minus 1 of delta. So I already use physics language measurement and state, but of course that's what's fair to do in this situation. And what we actually use here is not the random variable itself. We use the inverse image function of the random variable. We use a to the minus 1. A to the minus 1 takes a Borel subsets of the real line to Borel subsets of your sample space. So you should think of this as taking outcomes to subsets of the sample space. And then, of course, you can apply a probability measure to this because this assigns probabilities to subsets of your sample space. So in calculating probabilities, you actually use not the random variable itself, you use the inverse image function of it. And this is what I want to emphasize here. This is practically more important. Now, if we have a classical random variable A, and we have a probability measure as before, then you can form something called the cumulative distribution function. And this is written CA, and typically I will just say CDF because that's way too long. So the cumulative distribution function of A with respect to a measure mu is what? Well, it's a map from the real numbers to probabilities. You take a real number, you form the interval, the half open interval from minus infinity up to R, your real number, which is a subset of the real line. Then you take a to the minus 1 of this, which gives you a subset of your sample space. And you apply your measure to it, which gives you a probability. So the idea is, if you have a probability distribution, let's say this guy here, for every real number, you integrate up to that point. So you see you get something growing from 0 to 1 again. You integrate with respect to the probability measure. Okay, so, but this is purely classical, so, but we already see some similarity with this guy over here, with the spectral family, and we will use this later on. Now, this is a monotone, right, continuous function. It goes to zero if your real numbers go to minus infinity. It goes to one if r goes to plus infinity. And you can basically axiomatize these guys by using this as defining properties. Okay, there's something which is, well, it is well known, but it's surprisingly hard to find good textbook results on this. So the first thing I want to do is the same trick I did on the quantum side. I want to extend the definition of my CDF to the extended reals. But this is, again, not adding really anything. I just, at minus infinity, I make it zero. At plus infinity, I make it one. It doesn't change the thing. But then, just as in the situation I already talked about, for spectral families, I have a meat-preserving map, which will have a left adjoint. It's this function QA. And this is how it looks. Well, these functions are well known in classical probability. They are called quantile functions. You know, this upper percentile, lower quartile, these functions that they're used. This is where this comes from. Now, so the best of my knowledge, we really looked quite hard and asked several people. It is a new observation that these quantile functions are adjoints of CDFs. It's not deep or anything, but at least it's nice to know that they relate to each other in this way. Sometimes these quantile functions are called inverse CDFs. They're not strictly speaking an inverse, but they're an adjoint. That's what they actually are. All right, but we need a little bit more. The point is, let's look at a situation when we don't have a probability measure. So now, of course, we cannot actually map to probabilities, but we can still look at these inverse images of these half-open interval. Now, actually, it has become a closed interval because I can include minus infinity because I've extended to the extended reals. But it doesn't make a difference, actually, technically. So let's just say I define a new function, c tilde a, which sends a real number to this. This is just some Borel subset of my sample space. I call this the B omega CDF of A. And it's quite easy to see that this will also have an adjoint, which I write as Q tilde. This will go the other way from the Borel subset of my state space to the extended reals. And we call this the B omega quantile function of A. The reason I'm doing this is you may have heard this a lot of times. In quantum theory, people always talk about projection valued measures. And to talk about these guys, we have to think a little bit, what's the analog on the classical side? The interesting thing is not this. The interesting thing is that this can be generalized very easily. And generalization is that to realize that you do not need this to be the Borel subsets of a classical state space. All we need for this trick with the adjoint to start going is that this here is a complete meat semilattice. This always is a complete meat semilattice. The extended reals are fine, but if we map into a complete meat semilattice, we can play this trick and define an adjoint because the adjoint functor theorem tells us we can do so. So let L just be a complete meat semilattice and let A to the minus one from the Borel subsets of the extended reals to L be a meat preserving map such that the empty set goes to the bottom element. Such a map is generalizing what we did so far. I'm not talking about sample space direct anymore. I'm kind of talking only about the measurable subsets, but they only have to follow meat semilattice. Yes, well, you have to be a bit careful with completeness versus sigma completeness, but yes, so we do this in the paper quite carefully, yes. Now, what I want to say is I want to think of such a map, A to the minus one, as the inverse image of some generalized random variable. And importantly, I do not need to define a function A going from the points of L to R, which would be the actual random variable. Maybe these points of L don't even exist. Yeah. The random variable is a function on your sample space. The inverse image is something that maps into the Borel subsets of your sample space. I argued I'm more interested in the inverse image, and I generalize this now. I generalize it to a point where I don't have to think necessarily of an underlying set whose subsets are these Borel subsets. I just need to map into a meat simulator. Implicitly, I think there is some kind of random variable, but I don't have to have an underlying point set. And this, of course, seems attractive in quantum theory. We know we can't have underlying point sets as sample spaces. So I want to get in the position where I can argue that, in a way that covers the classical and the quantum case. Okay, so of course, implicitly, we think there is some kind of generalized random variable A, and I define just as before a map from R now into this meat semilattice, but it looks exactly as before, and I call this an L CDF of A, and it will have an adjoint which goes the opposite direction. I call this the L quantile function. Okay. Now, this is, I know it's a series of definitions, and it's taking stuff we know in classical probability, but it's generalizing it to a point where, for example, I do not have to assume there's an underlying sample space in the sense that my thingy I map into are the Borel subsets of this sample space, and also do not have to assume that L is a distributive lattice. Just saying it's a meat semilattice. Don't even have to talk about joints at this point. Okay, and we actually need it. We use it in quantum theory. It's a slightly non-standard presentation of what we do there, but many of these things I'll say in the next few slides are well known, but I'll add a few aspects. So if we look at a self-adjoint operator again, and if you now want to do quantum probability, then people always say the self-adjoint operator is a quantum random variable. And it gives us a projection-valued measure. And what is this? Well, it's the so-called spectral measure of A. And from the spectral theorem, we get the following. Self-adjoint operator gives, and it's given by, a map, right, this EA, taking Borel subsets of the spectrum to projection operators. This is, well, basically what it does. You take some subset here of the real line, and you look which of these projections you lie above it, and so you take the joint of these above it. That is how you get this. Now, in our interpretation of random variables, what is this guy? Well, this is the inverse image of a quantum random variable. This is the inverse image function of a quantum random variable. It takes subsets of outcomes to subsets of the sample space, which here is the Hilbert space. So conceptually, that is the inverse image of a quantum random variable. But of course, it's different from the classical situation. We do not map into subsets of a set. We map into linear subspaces of a Hilbert space, or the corresponding projection operators. One thing that also worried me a little bit is self-adjoint operator does not look like a classical random variable. It's not a function on any kind of sample space. So what do we do there? Well, it's quite simple if you look at a single operator. You can always find some algebra, right? This VA, which is for Norman algebra, but it's a commutative algebra that contains A. It's the smallest one that contains A. This has what is called a Gelfand spectrum. This is an actually honest topological space. And this is a space of pure states on your commutative algebra. And then you can look at what's called closed and open subsets of this space. And this is a complete Boolean algebra. So it's very much like a classical sample space with measurable subsets. And actually, there's an ISO between the projections in your algebra and the Clopen subsets of the spectrum. So instead of mapping into projections, you can equivalently map into these Clopen subsets. So this really starts to look like a classical random variable, or the inverse image of it. And here is the actual function I want to define. It's a function from this sample space to the space of outcomes, which of course is the spectrum of the operator. And this is called the Galfan transform of A. So this guy is the direct analog of a classical random variable. It's an actual honest function on an honest topological space. The usual thing people always do, and I'll do this in the following as well, is they argue, okay, we can always switch between operators and these Galfan transform these functions. So we'll talk about the self-adjoint operators as random variables as usual. But you could have these functions. Now, of course, if you have two non-commuting operators, they will not lie in a commutative phenomenal subalgebra. So their Galfan transforms will not be defined on the same space. You have different spaces here. So this is exactly the usual thing to say. There's no joint sample space for these guys. This is where this comes in. Okay. Now we come actually to the interpretation of these functions, these real-valued functions on projections. What do they actually mean? So we saw that a quantum random variable gives us this spectral measure, and this is a measure with values in P of H, a projection lattice. And this in particular is a complete meet semi-lattice. So we can define what we did before. We can define a map EA from the real numbers into this meet semi-lattice by taking, well, I said this is the inverse image of my quantum random variable. So do this. So the spectral family is what I would call the P of H CDF of A. This is what I called, I talked about L CDFs before. L is a meet semi-lattice. Here L is P of H. So I said I need a level of generality where I can talk about quantum and classical at the same time. In particular, P of H is a non-distributive lattice, you know, which is not so easy to see in the usual setting, how to formulate this. So this map will have a left adjoint, and this is this function. That's exactly the guy we had defined before. So this is the Q-observable function. It is the left adjoint of the spectral family. And in these probability terms, it is the quantum quantile function. And again, we looked through the literature. We couldn't find this. So this seems to be new. You think about self-adjoint operators as quantum random variables, as is the usual thing in quantum probability. And you can define quantile functions for these, and these are exactly these functions I introduced. So that is their actual interpretation. That's what these guys do. Okay. Time's running, so I'll be quite brief. In quantum theory, of course, we expect that states take the role of probability measures. So if you have a normal state row of your algebra, in this picture, we have so far the Hilbert space is your sample space. The projections or the closed subspaces are the measurable subsets. So the probability measure should take projections to probabilities. And of course, it does that. You'd get a probability measure by just evaluating rho on P. And this gives you a number between 0 and 1 for every projection. So the states, of course, in quantum theory give you the probability measures. And if you want to calculate something from your quantum mechanical formalism, use the Born rule. This says, well, you want to calculate the probability that the outcome of a measurement of A will lie in delta. You form mu rho of EA delta. EA delta takes this subset of the real line to a projection operator. Mu rho takes the projection operator to a probability. Okay. So again, because this is the inverse image of the quantum random variable, we see that if you want to calculate numbers, that's the thing we want to look at. So here is an overview of classical versus quantum probability. And as I said, much of this is well known, but I want to point out two or three things that are not necessarily standard. So this definition of L CDFs and L quantile functions is not standard. This is what we looked at in some detail. And then you have here the usual CDFs. and you can write them as composites. You first do your L quantile function, and then you apply the measure. This gives you this guy. On the quantum side, it looks very similar. You have this here, which is the L or P of H CDF in this case, and you apply this measure, which takes projections to 0, 1. So the new aspect is kind of this decomposition of the CDF into these two parts, determined up here. And the quantile function, again, is the left adjoint of the CDF. I didn't write down the definition, but you see there's a lot of structural similarity, but there are differences in the following sense. The sample spaces are quite different. Here you have a linear space, a Hilbert space on the quantum side, while here you have an actual set. And likewise, the character of these lattices L here, the Mead-Simon lattice, is different. Here L is Borel subsets of the sample space. Here it's this non-distributive orthomodular lattice P of H. And okay, I'll be quite brief for the last part. I want to show that the Topos approach gives us some ideas how to define a sample space also on the quantum side, which brings it even closer to this classical picture. Where in particular, you get something which is much more like an underlying set. And the way I want to do this is, well, I'll show you in a second. So the question is there such a sample space? Well, first of all, it should generalize this Gelfand spectrum, because you saw in the commutative situation, this is a good notion of sample space with this Gelfand transform as a random variable. But we would have to generalize this to non-abelian phenomenon algebras. And secondly, this should come equipped with some family of measurable subsets, analogous to the Clopen subsets of the Gelfand spectrum. It should serve as a common domain for all the random variables, and hence as a common codomain for the associated spectral measures or inverse images of the random variables, and serve as a domain for the states of the quantum states seen as probability measures. And the claim is the Topos approach gives you something like this in the form of the so-called spectral presheaf. And this can be defined quite generally, but again, I'll focus on the case of all bounded operators on Hilbert space here. But how can we do this even? Because there are pretty strong theorems showing there is no joint sample space. And technically, one other way of saying this is non-commutative operator algebras do not have spectra of this form. And that is, of course, true. And the trick, so to say, is to say, OK, we do not demand that our sample space is a single set anymore. It can be a generalized set. It can be a so-called presheaf. It's an object in a topos, which is a particular kind of category where the objects behave set-like in many respects, but they don't have to be sets. And in particular, we define the spectral presheaf. I want to read this out quickly. So this guy sigma here. And how does it work? Well, first thing is, to each commutative subalgebra V, you assign its Gelfand spectrum. So you get a whole bunch of topological spaces, and you can think of them as classical sample spaces. And secondly, whenever you have that one algebra is contained in a larger one, you get a function from the sample space of the large algebra to that of the smaller one, which is given in some canonical way. It's a restriction map, actually. Now, the power of the story is here. It's not having this whole collection of classical sample spaces. The power is in how they are glued together. You can think of this spectral presheaf as gluing together all the classical sample spaces, these Gelfand spectra. That's the whole idea. The whole thing in itself is not a set anymore. It's a big collection of sets with functions between them that relate things. And by going from sets to presheaves, to this particular presheaf, we can circumvent these no-go theorems. And no time is running, so I won't be able to do everything in great detail. The next thing you think about is, what are the measurable subsets of my quantum sample space? They're so-called Clopen subobjects, and they form what is called a Bayes-Hiting algebra. That is pretty exotic structure, I admit, not very well known, but actually it's a nice thing. It's a generalization of Boolean algebra where you split the idea of negation, the concept of negation, into two different concepts. But you keep distributivity. And this keeps many good logical properties. So I didn't talk about logic here because this is about probability, but another branch of this whole topos approach is about logic. And this has very nice consequences for quantum logic if you use this algebra. It's much better behaved than interpreting P of H logically, which you do in standard quantum logic. Okay, then we need something like an inverse image of a random variable. So this now should take Borel subsets of the real line to such Clopen subobjects of the quantum sample space. And there we use some other thing we have in the topos approach, which is a map from projections to Clopen subobjects. And so once you have this, of course, you simply compose. You take your spectral measure. This takes Borel subsets of the real line to projections, as we saw. And then you apply this map, which takes you further on to Clopen subobjects. So in this way, we have these inverse images of random variables. And you can define the corresponding LCDFs and L quantile functions. I'll just skip this. And then I just want to say very briefly, you can define probability measures on your quantum sample space. And again, you look at this definition. There's no reference to a quantum state at all. This is purely in terms of the structures we have. So it's saying we have a map taking measurable subsets to probabilities. And here you have the usual inclusion-exclusion principle. That's what you demand. And this is a normalization condition. The whole thing gets mapped to one. Nothing further, no reference to a quantum state, but the result we have is if your Hilbert space is at least three-dimensional, then every such probability measure gives you a unique quantum state and vice versa. So these probability measures are quantum states. Again, they do not look like the usual quantum states, but they do exactly the same thing. And so you can think of quantum states as probability measures in this formulation, and the last thing is actually showing that the Born rule is also captured. I want to calculate numbers from my formulas. I want to get the usual probabilities. And I do exactly formally the same that I did before. So I want to calculate the probability that the outcome of a measurement of A lies in the Borel set delta. So you form A to the minus 1 of delta, which takes this subset of outcomes to a subset of the quantum sample space. Then you apply your measure, which takes this to probabilities. There's one fine point I skipped over a little bit. What you actually get is not a single probability. You get one probability in every commutative subalgebra. But it's very easy to show the following. The actual quantum mechanical probability value, this is what you calculate from the Born rule, is the minimum of this function. So you look through all contexts, you look for the smallest value that shows up here. That's the actual quantum mechanical probability. What this says, what you calculate here, actually contains more information than just the usual probability. There's some stuff you can throw away, you just want the minimum, but it's certainly there. So in this sense, we capture the Born rule in this topos reformulation as well. And we could apply exactly the same machinery. This is why I had to develop this LCDF, L quantile function stuff, because the only thing I'm varying now is what meat simulators I'm using. And here I'm using the Clopen subobjects of our quantum sample space. And so this is the final slide. Here is this comparison now. This is quantum probability in this topos formulation. And it looks even closer to the classical probability. Particular sample spaces are more similar in character than you have in the usual formulation. Okay, that's it.
Questions? So I was wondering to what extent you can do these similar kinds of constructions with PAVMs where you don't have a lattice.
Yeah, much of it should go through the spectral order makes the POVMs into a complete lattice. It's not just boundedly complete because they are between 0 and 1 anyway, so they are global bounds. And I think this should be used, and I've never written a paper on this. I have some ideas for years, but usually POVMs, you know, it's a pain that the meets and joints or these often written as a plus that only exists under very specific conditions. This is much better behaved in this respect because you can form meets and joints of arbitrary families of effects. Yeah. And much of this would go through because, as I said, I set up the machinery with Barry to a degree where you just have to map into a complete meet semi-lattice, and POVMs form such a complete meet semi-lattice. You could do these things, and I think it's worthwhile doing. It's just in the paper we wanted to argue more or less that standard quantum probability fits into this, but the machinery is there to apply it to this more general situation.
I just missed the beginning of the question due to some audio problems, but what's the question about using effect algebra instead of lattice projection?
Yes, basically, yes. So if this would also apply to POVMs, and short answer is yes, but certainly one has to sit down and do it, but the machinery is there.
But is it necessarily true that those effect algebras which appear, generally with algebraic structures which appear as a result of algebraization of the sets of effects for POVMs, do they satisfy this mid semi-lattice property in general?
As I said, I mean, I was first of all thinking of effects as operators between 0 and 1. So they're self-adjoint or positive operators between 0 and 1, and then you equip them with a spectral order, you actually get a complete lattice. So, of course, it's a complete meet semi-lattice, so this works on the nose, and there's nothing else to do. If you want to generalize, of course, then you have to think which order can you put there. But I think some version of the spectral order should be very useful in these considerations. And, so I said on the first slide, there's this tension. If you want to calculate numbers from your formalism, the spectral aspects and the linear aspects, they don't go hand in hand. And I emphasized order, which relates directly to the spectral theorem and the spectral aspects. This is why these functions easily produce the spectrum of the operator, for example. It's very straightforward. This was this little lemma. I showed the proof, but I didn't read through it. But what becomes much harder in this picture, if you go from, let's say, a self-adjoint operator to the corresponding q-observable function, this is not a linear map. So linear aspects are not preserved in this. They're only preserved in the commutative situation. There, everything goes hand in hand. The linear and the spectral aspects behave in parallel very, very nicely. It's very easy. I personally would like to see very much what can we still say about linear structure and how can we learn something. But this is notoriously hard. And this is an amazing fact that it's a question that people like Euler and Gauss could have wondered about. You take two n by n matrices, symmetric, we'll say self-adjoint. You know the eigenvalues, you know the eigenspaces. Let's call them A and B. So now form A plus B gives you a new matrix. What can you say about the eigenvalues of A plus B in terms of the eigenvalues of A and B? And this question was solved in 1999. Not in 1700 something. Yeah. It's a very, very hard question. There's a very good paper by Kliachko, and you need serious mathematics to say this. And this is precisely because we relate spectral aspects. You want to know the eigenvalues of A plus B, and linear aspects because we form A plus B. And we talk about finite dimensions and self-adjoint operators. Yeah. So it was neither, I don't know, there must have been some progress on this, but 99, it was only possible in finite dimensions and only for self-adjoint operators. The other cases were still open. So that is how hard this question is. It seems like an exercise, but it's really hard. And the way what you get, Kliashko, does not give you some closed formula for producing the eigenvalues of A plus B. It gives a set of inequalities they have to satisfy, and they are quite complicated inequalities. And what he showed, that he gives a complete set of inequalities. The number of inequalities known up to that point, which all picked some aspects of this problem, but the great insight was that this is a complete set of inequalities. So these are hard questions. So, and in quantum theory, arguably, we're very much interested in producing these numbers, these probabilities, expectation values. And that may be somewhat misleading to emphasize the linear aspects, as we do most of the time. So producing these numbers, this probabilistic perspective may be quite useful. And then if you can see at the same time that these usual no-go things, there is no joint sample space and so on, they do not necessarily hold if you're a bit more lenient with what you accept as a sample space. You can do a lot of things. So I think that's quite interesting. This is why I said I learned something about quantum probability. At least for me, it's somewhat clearer now. And,
question about the slide, two slides before. You say you recover the bond rule and you recover the usual quantum probability series. All the numbers between 0 and 1 are added probabilities. What's your interpretation of this?
Sorry, what about
so
all
say,
the numbers?
You say you recover, so you have these Borel sets. And
yes.
You get, so you do A minus 1 and you use the measure.
Yes.
You get not one number between 0 and 1, but you get all other numbers between 0 and 1.
Yeah.
And so the question is, I understand one of them is a quantum mechanical probability.
Yes.
What's the other ones? What's the meaning of them?
Okay. I should have said that this minimum is attained in every commutative subalgebra that actually contains the operator A. And so this is not very surprising. If you perform a measurement of A, you implicitly pick a commutative subalgebra or a context in which you can measure A. If you pick some other context which does not contain A, you, as you know very well, you have to coarse grain. You actually would use this autodazenization of self-adjoint operators, which gives an operator which is bigger in the spectral order, which implies it's bigger in the linear order. This is an argument. Normally, the implication goes the other way around, but in this case, it's also bigger in the linear order. And this means the probability you calculate will get bigger.
Yeah,
so in the context that do not contain A,
is there a direct interpretation of these numbers?
Yeah, this is direct interpretation. It's the expectation value of the autodazenized operator in the context. He's my student, so he knows what I'm talking about. So
that's not really that's definition. I understand that. My question is,
then you have to interpret what this autodazenization means. Well, it is an approximation of the spectral order. You can write down what this means. I mean, I should say this. Let's do this later on a piece of paper. It's not very hard, but it's also not very informative to do it right now.
Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Andrew.